my special privilege to welcome Harris Sherman back to his native Colorado. We're fortunate to have him as our keynote speaker today, and we're pleased we could accommodate his peripatetic schedule as he attends to duties in 11 states and 4 days. Harris is indeed a dear friend of us here. He has a stunning record of public service in natural resources. He appears today as Undersecretary of Agriculture, a title that understates what it is over. The influence of the position is enormous in shaping especially public land policy for the national forests that are located within the Department of Agriculture. He was appointed by President Obama to that position to succeed Mark Rae, who was President Bush's appointee. Harris comes to the role with an impressive record. As a young lawyer, Harris was appointed by Governor Richard Lamb to head the Colorado Department of Natural Resources. This was the era when Colorado's Democratic governor went toe-to-toe with Democratic President Carter over a hit list of federal dams, and that hit list eventually led to the scuttling of several western dams, including some in Colorado, and a dispute over a federal energy plan that was designed to expedite energy development in the West. In the middle of the oil shale frenzy of the era, he created a joint review process for energy developers to obtain multiple permits efficiently, but in a more rigorous and rational way. He helped the governor create a trust fund to support local governments from energy impacts, and that proved to be a godsend when the oil shale boom went bust. There were impacts. He also helped create Colorado's Natural Areas Program. Now, if you've ever worked with, for, or especially opposite Harris Sherman, you know the adjectives tenacious and persuasive fit him well. He persuaded a hidebound, tradition-enslaved Washington, D.C. law firm to buck its founder's aversion to branch offices and to set up its one and only branch office in Denver. He went on to build the Arnold and Porter office and took on major natural resource matters representing ski industry and American Indian tribal clients in cases involving coal leasing, water, and land issues. All the while, Harris was deeply committed to public service work, serving on the board of the Trust for Public Land, of the Betcher Foundation, of Colorado College, and chairing and serving on public agency boards such as the Denver Water Department, the Colorado Water Quality Control Commission, the State Mine Land Reclamation Board, and the Denver Regional Air Quality Council. The lure of full-time public service, however, proved too much for him, and he answered Governor Ritter's call in 2007 and left private practice. Now, Harris is a true believer in recycling, and he was himself recycled back into the Department of Natural Resources, becoming executive director once again. He kept the job interesting, finding and pursuing new challenges. But within 2 years, he was asked by President Obama and our friend Secretary Vilsack to serve as Undersecretary at Agriculture. Like most effective holders of high office or judgeships, he had a record, and that record gave worries to some observers based on his highly active, if short, second term as DNR director. For environmentalists, it was Colorado's approach to the roadless rule that had rolled out and been defended by him over the objections of many environmental organizations. For the energy industry, it was a set of strong oil and gas regulations that are designed to ensure proper environmental and landowner protections. But he was confirmed solidly. And Harris is as his active schedule shows, fully engaged in his new responsibilities. He's made an historic announcement in the form of a noticed rulemaking. He's determined to rewrite and implement a new National Forest Planning Rule, the all-important framework for planning for national forests. Forest plans are the Bible for land managers in the Forest Service. And the planning process has become bogged down by legal sparring and politics. It's anathema for career people and a disappointment for the public. Harris has set out to change this. In doing so, he visits and revisits some of the assumptions and recommendations of the Public Land Law Review Commission, and he aims to create a new vision for the public's forest lands. He told a few of us visiting his office recently that he wants this to be the capstone of his career, a truly impressive career already. Please welcome Harris Sherman.
Well, thank you very much. It's really great to be back in Colorado. I regret to say I've only been here three times in the last 6 months, and as a lifelong Coloradan, there is no other place in the world like this wonderful state. So it's great to be back, and I remember 14 months ago, David and I were having dinner at his home, and we were talking about the new Obama administration, and we were talking about the virtues and the pitfalls of going back to Washington and being part of a new public service. And I thought David would be smart enough to put his hat in the ring, but he was smart enough to stay here. And meanwhile, I'm back in Washington working very hard, but it's wonderful work, and I'm enjoying it tremendously. It's good to be back at this school. I had the privilege of serving on the Natural Resource Board here for many years. I was a colleague and admirer of Clyde Martz. He was just a towering figure in the legal world and contributed so much. So I'm delighted that this conference is named after him. This morning and yesterday, I was in Montana, and we were having the first of the presidential listening sessions on America's Great Outdoors. So it was really a wonderful event because the president has charged the Secretary of Agriculture and Interior, the head of EPA, the head of CEQ, and their sub-cabinets and staffs with going around the country and getting the best ideas we can find for doing a number of things. One is to strengthen how we conserve our public lands and how we can improve our stewardship of public lands. Another one of the president's charges was to come back with new ideas about how we can strengthen our working lands in America, our farms and our ranches and our private forest. And the president wants to hear more about how do we connect people to the land? How do we get people outdoors to take advantage of this extraordinary resource that we have in America that really sets us aside from just about any other country on the planet? So we were in Montana. We had a wonderful exchange yesterday and this morning with people from all over the state who had all kinds of great ideas for us to take back to Washington. And I just have to say, when we were out in a pasture yesterday and there were several hundred people talking to the Secretary of Agriculture, one of these people raised his hand, and I have to get the exact expression here. He raised his hand and he said, "Well, Charles Wilkinson talks about a historic hangover." And everybody looked, and Charles, do you know what I'm talking about? This historic hangover. Well, it turns out this person kind of botched it slightly. He was talking about checkerboarded land patterns and how complicated they were. And Charles once talked about this as being a historical hangover. So Charles, I regret to say there's nobody there to clear your name, and I just didn't know what to do about this. I have to say, in reviewing the agenda for today and the two following days, this is a wonderful conference, and I'm really sorry in a way we couldn't make this part of the president's listening sessions, because obviously what you're going to be talking about and discussing has enormous importance for both our public and private lands. And I would hope, David, that we could, if certain specific ideas come out of this, that you could let us know and we could incorporate that into the record that we're trying to prepare. What we're going to try to do is we're going to probably go to 10 or 15 places around the country, hold these listening sessions, and then we will come back and we will write a report to the president on what recommendations we have based on what we've heard. And my hope is that in 2011, that will work its way into the federal budget, into changes in administrative programs and policies, and certainly maybe lead to certain statutory changes as well. So stay tuned on that front. And if you have ideas, we would really love to know what they are. Well, the last 6 months since I've been in Washington, I have been drinking from the proverbial fire hydrant. It has been just an enormous array of issues that you see when you're overseeing the U.S. Forest Service and the Natural Resources Conservation Service. These are two terrific agencies. Some of my colleagues are here today, and there is just a wide scope of very, very challenging and emerging issues that we are grappling with. I think it's fair to say that 6 months ago, I only had a relatively vague idea of the magnitude of the challenges that we are dealing with. And I also, though, only had a relatively vague idea of the opportunities for genuine change in how we approach these issues. I think there is an opportunity that we have in front of us that we really need to take advantage of. And I'll talk more about that this afternoon. So let me just begin, and I hope I'm not repeating my colleague Rick Cables, who was on a panel just earlier, but let me just begin by giving you a brief overview of the health of our national forests. Just talk about that for a moment, because I think it frames the challenges that we have ahead. The Forest Service oversees approximately 10% of the land mass of the United States. That's 193 million acres. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 of the 193 are forest, and the balance are national grasslands. Now, of the 150 million acres of national forest, somewhere in the neighborhood of 110 to 115 million acres are in need of serious restoration. Many of these forests are, first of all, single age, and they tend to be very old. They are monolithic in the sense that they lack diversity, and they're dense. These are not healthy ecosystems. And these forests are ultimately not providing the ecosystem services that I think we all look to the forest to provide. And so ultimately, we're not going to have a sustainable situation with the nation's forest unless we do some fairly bold things in the future. We can blame climate change for part of this. There's no question that that has caused part of this. We can blame past fire suppression policies for the current health of our forest. But we also have to look to population growth. We have to look to where we have developed and built. We like to talk about the so-called WUI, the wildland-urban interface, where there are literally thousands of communities around the country that are now within the wildland-urban interface area. And clearly, the fragmentation of our national forest has hurt the health of those forests as well. Fire instead of diminishing, fire is a growing threat to the nation and its national forest. Approximately half of our nation's forests now are in the moderate to severe category for uncharacteristic severe wildfires. Half of our national budget for the Forest Service, over $2 billion a year, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.5 billion a year, goes for fire preparation and fire suppression. We are seeing larger, more frequent, intensive mega fires occurring in this country. Historically, it was rare that we would see more than 5 million acres a year burn on private and federal lands. In the last several years, we are now in the 5 to 10 million acre category. And we're looking probably, according to the experts, to start to exceed 10 million acres a year of forests that are on fire. Now, that creates a whole series of interesting dilemmas for us. I had the privilege of serving on the Denver Water Board for a number of years when we dealt with the aftermath of the Hayman Fire and the Buffalo Creek Fire. And those two fires almost brought the Denver system to its knees. It really complicated Denver's intake systems, its reservoirs. We were dealing with erosion issues, water quality issues, you name it. And Denver has probably spent over $50 million just dealing with the aftermath of those two fires. The Hayman Fire was about 136,000 acres of land. But last year in Los Angeles at the Station Fire, we saw a fire that was 180,000 acres. So fire is, and its threat to water quality is massive. Now, we're also dealing, because of climate change, with increased epidemics of disease and pest. And Rick Cables and I talk all the time about the bark beetle. Well, the bark beetle in Colorado, we have about 3.5 million acres of land that is subject to the bark beetle. In the entire western United States, there's about 17 million acres of land that have been decimated by the bark beetle. And in Canada, there's over 30 million acres that have died as a result of the bark beetle there. Well, the bark beetle poses all kinds of interesting challenges for us. In terms of protecting watersheds, the fire threat that comes from it, and now we have this increasing problem of just protecting public health and safety. Rick Cables and I just did the simple math on what this means. And if you take three national forests in northern Colorado and southern Wyoming, these three national forests, because of the millions of acres of dead trees, every day, on average, for the next decade, 100,000 trees a day are going to fall down in these three national forests. And these are forests which have intensive recreation. So the threat to hikers, mountain bikers, people on horseback, campgrounds, the threat to public utility lines, electric lines, transmission lines, these are real emerging challenges that the Forest Service is looking at as we go forward. And I won't bog down on invasive species, but the invasive species problem, which is not as visible a problem, but there's no question that our public lands are the subject of an unprecedented number of invasive species covering an unprecedented number of acres. So what to do about all this? My boss, Secretary Vilsack, he's from Iowa, and he loves to kid that there's only 6 trees in all of Iowa. And that's probably right. But nevertheless, he is absolutely committed to taking this challenge on and doing something important to correct past problems. He gave a speech in Seattle last August, which I thought was just an outstanding speech, in which he dealt with a number of these issues. He focused on 4 or 5 strategies. One of them was he wanted to emphasize all lands. He thought it was a misguided approach for the Forest Service to simply look at our lands and not look beyond our lands, because all of these issues that we're dealing with, fire, water, invasive species, disease, so forth. There are no boundaries to these problems. And so he really called for a, quote, all lands approach, where we would work with our sister federal agencies, state agencies, and private landowners to deal with these issues. And secondly, he wanted to focus much more going forward on water. I mean, historically, the Forest Service probably has focused most on timber and mining and energy. All of those are important issues, without question. But water is an important issue. Wildlife is an important issue. Recreation is a very important issue. And so the Secretary really wanted us to focus on these and to think about the ecosystem services that the national forests provide, and to start to incorporate climate change into all of the issues that we deal with on every level. The Secretary called for an all-out effort to restore the nation's forest, and he wanted us to start doing this on a landscape scale basis instead of focusing on 1,000 acres here and 1,000 acres there, and I'll come back to that in a minute. And the Secretary talked a lot about the jobs that our national lands, our national forests can provide for rural areas. You know, we have a ongoing, very difficult problem sustaining the economy of rural areas around this country. And the Secretary felt that these restoration efforts could be very important in terms of strengthening rural communities and their opportunities over a longer period of time. And last but not least, he called for greater efforts at collaboration, because without collaboration, it is virtually impossible to get anywhere if we bog down on litigation and on conflict. So since I've been in Washington, we have taken these themes, and we're now trying to figure out where we go from here and how we build some programs and expand programs within the Forest Service to deal with these challenges. So what I'd like to do is focus first and foremost on the issue of restoration, because restoration goes to the heart of pretty much everything we are doing today at the Forest Service. And there's a half a dozen to a dozen strategies that in Washington and out in the field we are now taking a very intensive look at. So the first thing about restoration is we are trying to take a holistic view of what needs to be done in the forest. So it's not just a question of getting the trees out of the forest. It's a question of how do you restore the forest after you get the trees out? How do we thin our forest, but then how do we revegetate and replant within our forest? How do we improve the riparian corridors? How do we improve our streams? How do we improve wildlife habitat? How do we decommission roads that are no longer needed? How do we fix culverts? We need to take a holistic view of the issue of restoration. Secondly, in our budget historically has, we've had bunkers where we have over on this side a timber removal budget, and over on this side we have a wildlife budget, and over here on this side we have a watershed budget. We are trying to combine our budgets for all of these different areas so that we have an integrated budget that reflects this holistic view that we are pursuing. We're in the process right now of trying to convince Congress that this is a good thing to do. And we're trying to convince a lot of the constituencies, the stakeholders that deal with us, that this is a good thing to do that doesn't threaten them. So the environmental community may feel threatened by the fact that we're combining these budgets and there's not a specific line item on one side to deal with watershed priorities or wildlife habitat priorities. Or the timber industry may be concerned that we no longer have a specific item that relates to the removal of timber. But we're trying to explain to everybody that we think if we combine these together under a lens of restoration, a rising tide will ship sail all boats. And that is our goal with the budget. And we will see where we get in this current budget review by Congress. We are trying our best to look at the landscape scale effort. Instead of so-called random acts of conservation, we're trying to look at a much, much broader view of where we go. And let me give you a couple examples. In the Chesapeake Bay area, this is an area that includes, I think, something like 11 states. There are tremendous water quality problems in the Chesapeake Bay. What is the role of the United States Forest Service and NRCS in working with these states to improve the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay? Well, obviously the health of our forest will have a direct impact on the water quality of Chesapeake Bay. So there we're looking at a landscape of 1.4 million acres, and what can we do to provide helpful solutions to improving water quality in the bay? The longleaf pine forest in southeastern United States. There was once 90 million acres of longleaf pine. Today there's 3.5 million acres. So we're focused with six or seven states on how do we start to rebuild these forests on a massive scale. There is the four forest area in Arizona. These folks have gotten together. They want us to address 750,000 acre restoration effort in Arizona. It's unprecedented for that part of the country. Senator Wyden talks to me frequently about the east side of the Cascades, where they want to focus on 2 million acres of land, which are in need of restoration. And my friends in Colorado along the Front Range here and the Uncompahgre area in southwestern Colorado are talking about landscape scale efforts as well. So we're starting to see this throughout the country. And I think this is just an incredibly positive step in the right direction. Now, as part of dealing with the landscape scale, another goal of ours is to really evaluate what we can do to further collaboration. And I have to say that I think here, more than almost anywhere else, things are shifting, and people are adopting a very different approach to what to do about the nation's forest. Historically, the environmental community and the timber industry have been locked in an ongoing legal struggle, which has, to a large extent, shut down the work on the national forest. But things are changing. The environmental community, and I meet with a lot of the environmental leaders in the United States, they recognize how urgent the need is to restore the national forest. They are recognizing increasingly that the only way they can do that is to have a strong timber industry, because the only way you're going to get the logs out of the forest is to have a timber industry to help remove the logs. It's clearly not something the federal government alone can do. And conversely, the timber industry is realizing that stewardship includes more than taking the trees out. It includes a broad set of responsibilities about restoring the nation's forest. And this is an opportunity for the timber industry to broaden its approach to these issues and to really take on new assignments, new responsibilities related to conservation. So these groups are getting together now. It is remarkable how we are seeing throughout the United States collaboratives coming in, where you have groups that didn't speak to each other 5 years ago. And they are working arm in arm about proposals they want us to work with them on to restore the nation's forest. So I think these are very exciting opportunities that we need to give very serious attention to. And the Forest Service really needs to understand how we can help to facilitate that process. And that's something we are talking about, both in our planning efforts and other efforts throughout the nation's forest. Now, one of the other areas we are focused on, and it's really important, is the role that bioenergy, biomass, can play in helping us to restore the nation's forest. I have been really impressed by this growing number of prototype projects of taking wood and converting it to heat and to electricity, or taking wood and converting it to fuel. We're not quite there yet with certain technologies, and the economics of it still need some help. But the federal government is examining ways that we can work with these entities through programs such as the BCAP program, or rural development programs, or special loan programs, so that we can put these folks on an even footing so that they can help us to do these restoration efforts. There's a lot of exciting progress there, and you should stay tuned in terms of what the future can hold on that front. Obviously, money is a problem. It costs a lot of money to do this work. We're spending now somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 billion a year on restoration of the forest. And that's a lot of money, but when you think about the millions of acres, hundreds of millions of acres that need attention, we simply don't have the resources that are needed to do the job. So we are working to identify partnerships with the beneficiaries of the National Forest to help us. And I'm very excited about some of the emerging opportunities that are coming our way. For example, water, 60 million people in this country get their drinking water from the National Forest. Well, we're reaching out to the water providers, and we're starting to have a dialogue with them about how they can work with us in a partnership to help restore the nation's forest. Santa Fe, New Mexico has a fascinating prototype project where they are essentially imposing a surcharge on users, on residents of Santa Fe, to help fund projects on the national forest. The city of Denver, through the Denver Water Board, is contemplating a program where they will join us in a partnership to work to restore the forest on national forest land, because that's Denver's watershed. We're talking to other municipal water providers in other parts of the country about this as well. So that's a partnership that has some possibilities. Other partnerships that have merit may relate in part to, say, the recreation industry. The Vail Ski Resort. The Vail Ski Resort puts a voluntary surcharge on every lift ticket it sells. And unless you want to opt out of that program, that dollar you pay goes into a fund, which helps to restore forest around Vail, as well as other parts of Colorado. Every lodge you stay at in the town of Vail imposes a surcharge, again, a voluntary surcharge, but this is, again, designed to contribute money to the protection of the national forest. The electric utility industry is increasingly concerned about the well-being of their transmission lines. So we're talking to them about stepping forward with us to work on a partnership to, again, improve these forests so we can lessen the danger of fire. We're going to keep working on these various partnerships because this is really an important way for us to make sure that we can bring at least more resources to the table to help us deal with the challenges ahead. I haven't talked a lot about fire. I'm not going to do that other than to say that we are expanding and looking at ways to use prescribed fire as part of the restoration process. Obviously, we have to do this very carefully. Public health and safety comes first. Protection of private property comes second. But prescribed fire is an important tool that can be used to restore our forest. The American Indians did this a lot, and they did it very successfully for hundreds of years. And we're just beginning to learn some of the things they did so successfully in the past. We are also taking a look at the National Environmental Policy Act. The National Environmental Policy Act is clearly one of the mainstays of our environmental programs in this country. You only have to look at what happened in the Gulf last month to realize how important it is that we do the analyses necessary in order to preclude the things that have happened. But I will say that sometimes when we're restoring national forest, and we have to go through very long, expensive, difficult, and often litigious environmental reviews, that can create some interesting obstacles and challenges for us. So we are open to learning more approaches, different approaches to how NEPA could be used in a way that helps to facilitate restoration. And, you know, we'd be curious, I'd be interested in your ideas on that subject as well. Well, let me, David, David referred to the planning process that the Forest Service is now focused on. And this is a very important next step for us. We are trying to, once again, promulgate a new national planning rule. We have been stymied in doing this for at least a decade because of various efforts that the courts have set aside. But this country absolutely needs a planning rule that we can rely on that is efficient, it's effective, and it really deals with the emerging issues that we have, the issues that I've been talking about. Right now, the Forest Service is essentially using a planning rule that goes back to 1982. It was a time when timber production was the focus of our national forest. I think we were producing something like 10 billion board feet back then. We're producing less than a quarter of that today. We weren't worried about climate change at the time. We weren't talking about ecosystem services. So we are working to set up a new planning effort, which hopefully will truly deal with the current and the emerging issues that face us. So this process is also going to be a very transparent one. Instead of simply coming out with a proposal on our end and asking you for your thoughts as part of a NEPA process, we have on the front end been conducting roundtables throughout the country to get ideas about what ought to go into this new planning rule. We have conducted science panels because good science should be at the heart of any planning rule. So we're going to move forward with this and very soon release to the public at least a draft of the concepts that we are hearing about based on these roundtables. And then we will take that through a National Environmental Policy Act review. But I hope all of you, if you have an interest in this, will pay very careful attention to it, because the planning rule obviously translates to what our forest plans look like throughout the country. All of the decisions we make are based on our forest plans, so it really is at the heart of our system. But this is a time and a place to get this planning rule right. And I'm not sure I'm tenacious, David, but if there's anything I want to get done here, it is to get this rule done in a way that survives legal challenge, number one, and really works and is a credit to the system. So let me stop there, and I would really welcome, almost use this on my part as a listening session to hear what you're thinking about these issues. I'm not sure whether we need a new public land law review commission. I sometimes wonder whether our planning process could be used in place of a public land law review commission as a way of airing a lot of these issues. But your thoughts on where we're going with our national forest, and for that matter, other public lands, would be very helpful to me. And we would love to incorporate those into our thinking about what we do with America Great Outdoor Initiative and what we do with our planning rule and other such things. So let me stop there and entertain any thoughts or questions you may have.